did you first get into music?
Well, I don't remember much of anything except music and baseball. You know, I started playing piano when I was 8, and my brother Gap was the first musician in our family, and he really got into it, and so he was kind of the leader as far as buying records and picking musical directions. And when I got more realistic about things, baseball kind of moved out of the picture, and I just continued to study and to play. So we did the Jewish bar mitzvah Italian wedding circuit with trumpet and accordion, and then got into having our own groups. And really, since about 14, I don't remember having to play too much music that I didn't really feel good with.
When did you start recording? I know I ran across an album of yours from 1960.
Right, that's exactly when the first album was made.
Is that the first one on Riverside?
Right, we had a group called the Jazz Brothers, which included Sal Nistico, a very fine saxophone player who did a lot of work with Woody Herman and Buddy Rich, and bass players included Jimmy Garrison and Steve Davis, both of whom worked with John Coltrane, and Roy McCurdy, the drummer who's been with Cannonball Adderley for about the last 7 years. All were in the original Jazz Brothers group, so we recorded 3 albums way back then, and now I guess they're collector's items because they don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
But if anybody sees the covers, they're going to have a good time with the crew cuts and Brooks's brother's suits and all that.
That's you wrote some tunes on that too.
Yeah, I got into writing at a pretty early age, and now we kind of play the music that I write almost exclusively, unless we can feel real close to somebody else's music or as close as we can identify with our own. I think if you get into playing other people's music too much, you really can't do it as well as the people who wrote it, you know, the original thing. And I think the worst thing anybody could say about our sound or our music is, gee, you sound just like, you know, this guy or that guy. And I think that's one of the reasons I put a group together, really, is to play the music that I believe in and that I write.
When did you start getting interested in performing with orchestra?
Well, I kind of fell in love with strings, really, rather than orchestras, at a very early age, listening to records like Billie Holiday, Lady in Satin, and the soundtrack from the movie Spartacus, records by Stan Getz, one particular album called Focus, and other records that involved string sections. And the only place I could find a string section was in an orchestra. So I started writing music for that instrumentation, and eventually created enough interest in Rochester to get an invitation to guest conduct the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra. And the results of that concert was our first album, Friends and Love album. And then subsequently we did another concert with them called Together, and have an album we recorded with the Hamilton Philharmonic Orchestra called Land of Make Believe. And our new album, Chase the Clouds Away, is the first album where we really have the total picture under one cover. You know, we've had quartet albums and orchestra albums, but on the Clouds album, there are cuts with orchestra, there's a cut with the quartet alone, and there's a cut with Esther Satterfield singing. So everybody is really showcased in a way that people might see us if they come out and hear us.
Several television specials.
Yes, 3 things for PBS television, and actually were videotaped at the same time the recordings took place. And that actually was the first national exposure that we had, even before the records got around, because the Friends and Love concert was released on a local label initially in Rochester, and was seen nationally on television before the record was available nationally. We've done Merv Griffin's show. We got a shot on there last year where he kind of fell in love with our music and allowed us something that really doesn't happen on, quote, commercial television too often, where they actually allowed us 12 consecutive minutes of music uninterrupted by commercial. As you know, in most very commercialized radio or television situations, anything longer than 2 minutes and 30 seconds is a crime. So we felt very flattered and very fortunate to get that much time.
Have you played outside of the States yet?
Yes, we're very strong in Toronto, and have played in other parts of Canada. We've been to the Montreux Festival in Switzerland. We've played the Pori Jazz Festival in Finland. We've been in London and Amsterdam and Italy. And this year we're looking forward to going back to Europe and also to Japan for the first time.
What do you think of the music that's happening nowadays? You see any direction in it?
Well, I don't think there is any particular direction. I think there's an overall feeling happening that music that involves improvisation is definitely moving more into the picture than ever before. I think that the standard, the medium of music, the quality is going upward. You know, I think young players are more sophisticated, young people are more sophisticated listeners, and I think it's showing in the music that's being accepted as the so-called popular music today.
How much improvisation is there in your music?
Quite a bit. I feel very fortunate to have a quartet made up of very superb musicians who are capable of handling any kind of direction as far as style, and who are exceptional improvisers. A guy like Jerry Niewood can stretch something that I write to the extremes, and Joe LaBarbera on drums is sensitive enough to be able to handle everything that's going on. Chip Jackson is more than just a good bass player. He's both a harmonic foundation and a very linear player as well. And there's structure to the music that we play. There's a lot of improvisation, but it's improvisation not based on free form or anything. There's a chord progression or a certain amount of space during which the improvisation happens, you know. And I think perhaps that's one of the reasons why people can come and go away from hearing our music. The bass player was terrific. They can actually remember a melody or something and still be very knocked out by the spontaneous things that happen. So there is quite a bit of improvisation involved in the music we play, whether it's with the quartet or with orchestra.
You started out playing trumpet, but now you play mostly flugelhorn?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I fell in love with the flugelhorn around 1963 when I was a student in school, and musicians were doing record comps of music that involved Gil Evans and Miles Davis, and Miles was playing flugelhorn, so they needed somebody to play the flugelhorn parts. And when I was introduced to the flugelhorn, I fell in love with the sound of it and felt that it suited my personality more, but wasn't in a musical environment that allowed me to play it all the time. So it wasn't until I formed my quartet in 1968 that I put the trumpet away and started playing flugelhorn all the time.
How does the sound differ from the trumpet?
Flugelhorn's a much more mellow sound. It's a darker sound. It doesn't have the brilliance. It's not meant to be an overpowering kind of instrument. I think it's a fatter, you know, rounder sound, and I like the way it blends with Jerry's soprano sax and flutes and things. So I just feel very good about it.
Goes lower than a trumpet.
Actually, it has the same range and the same key. I find it easier to play pedal tones on the flugelhorn, but basically, and from the instruction book point of view, it does have the same same range and the same key and fingerings as the trumpet.
Just a different color.
Yeah. It's like a pregnant trumpet, you know. That's what it looks like, anyhow. Dark.
Uh-huh. What do you see happening for the quartet in the future?
Well, we've already recorded our next album for A&M. The first one felt so good that we jumped back in the studio right away, and I'm sure won't be out till fall. But we've been enjoying an increase in the awareness of our music among people around the country, and we've decided that we're going to keep traveling, you know, and take the music to the people. And we've been building audiences in areas where we've never had exposure before, and we're enjoying, for example, doing a string of orchestra dates where we put the quartet inside of an orchestra and add the various soloists like Esther and Gap and various other people, and then to spend 5 days like this at the Quiet Night, and and enjoy the intimacy of a small room and, uh-huh. and what you can do in that direction. And if any kind of success comes our way, it'll just make it easier for us to do what we're doing now. You know, I think a lot of people are under the illusion that most musicians get into music to make a lot of bread quick and get out, you know. If I didn't have music to do tomorrow, I wouldn't know what to do. And music is the love of my life, and it's what I want to do. And I look to people, people like Duke Ellington, people like Pablo Casals, Louis Armstrong, just those people who did what they did for a very long time and just did it well and weren't concerned about being different every day, just being good every day and growing and let the music be an extension of what they were.
Uh-huh. That's very well said.
Well, I've really given it a lot of thought. You know, it took me a long time to just accept the fact that I wasn't in competition with anybody, you know. I was just meant to make music and to do it as best as I could. And I think that was an important step because you can wake up every day like comparing yourself to everybody. And how do I stack up against all the other flugelhorn people in the world or groups or, and all that. But I just enjoy having a good time making music, and that's what I'm going to do. And all of that other stuff is really things that have been indoctrinated into us as we, you know, grow up in a very competitive kind of society. And for me, I feel like... we exist in the land of make-believe to be able to play the music we believe in and have people enjoy it. To me, that's the total answer, the total picture, and I hope that keeps happening for a long time.
Reminds me like of a Balinese saying, that we have no art, we do everything as best as we can.
Mm. Yeah, I think a lot of people, you know, we did a so-called clinic the other day at Michigan State University. That's not where you get your teeth cleaned, but that's where you get together, I guess, with young musicians, and they ask questions about what's happening. And someone asked what rituals you go through before the job to get ready to play music, you know. Music is what we do, you know. You do radio, we do music, people are carpenters and people are cab drivers, and don't mean to belittle what we do in any kind of way, but... It is a spiritual thing, but I don't feel like there's any great preparation that goes into getting ready to make music. To me, it's just trying to contain the enthusiasm for wanting to get to the music every day, you know, with travel and hanging out in airports and living in hotels is not really what it's all about. It's getting to those 3 or 4 hours of music every night that make the day mean something so well. To just keep yourself from getting so excited that you can't function is really the only problem that I have, because I really look forward every day to making music with Chip, Joe, and Jerry, or whatever musical vehicle we're working with at the time.
Do a lot of rehearsing?
We work so much that we don't rehearse a whole lot. When new music comes along, we'll get together, but the music grows as we perform it, you know. There's some things that we're just now recording that we've been working at for quite some time, you know. And with the kind of people that I have in my group, a whole lot of rehearsal time isn't really necessary. Everybody reads very quickly, and I lean on the rhythm section to supply or suggest the feeling in one direction or another. And so we don't spend a whole lot of time preparing. When we do an orchestra concert, usually 6.5 hours is all the time you have to get a 2.5 hour concert together. So that's a different approach to rehearsing. It's kind of like hoping that the musicians become like sponges and can absorb all of that music in a day and a half and give it back to you. And every once in a while we have the luxury of having an orchestra together for maybe a week. And then you have the situation where that orchestra can get as loose with the music as the four of us can. And then you really get another kind of feeling out of an orchestra. Because most of the time, it's more than enough to expect them to get it just correct, you know. Uh-huh. because they're reading and there's a lot of music there to absorb. And that's why I'm really very pleased with all the recordings we've made live with orchestras, because they're exactly what happened 2 days after the people got introduced to the music, you know. And there's some very exciting times and moving moments in those recordings, and I think the audience contributes by keeping the musician honest. Uh-huh. And when you're playing for people, you gotta produce right then and there. And I think a lot of records done in studios where the approach is you can fix it later or overdub or correct something, it's kind of a safe thing, you know, approach, and can be pretty sterile, because the guy who put down the rhythm track has no idea what's going to be coming 3 days later when somebody walks in with a string section or somebody overdubs a solo. And the music that we play really involves communication amongst everybody who's performing, so we like to do it all at once.
It's very good. I think we're just about out of tape.
Okay.
I think we got some good things said.
Sure.
Be able to make something out of this.
Beautiful.
Thanks.
Oh, thank you.